Oh.
So my ears blocked.
That's if things go really well.
No, no, it's right there.
Oh, yeah, I can see it.
What?
I told Harry I wanted to see the... Call it order the House Committee on Healthcare for February 11th and open a public hearing on House Bill 2626. And call Representative Reardon. Sandy, will you introduce the bill for us, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Members of the committee, this House Bill 2626 authorizes the state treasurer to issue lottery bonds to finance grants from the Department of Education to school districts to pay for acquisition, construction, or improvement of school-based health centers. This has an emergency clause effective on passage.
Sir. Well, good afternoon. Thank you, Chair, for having me here. Greetings, committee members. It's good to be here. One of the best lobbyists we've ever had suggested that you should only speak if you have special knowledge and something to say. And so today I wanted to drop by and talk about school-based health care centers. And I think I have special knowledge. I was, up until being elected a couple of years ago, I was a teacher at David Douglas. And during that time, we did introduce a school-based health center. It was on campus. And just wanted to just say just a couple of words, I think, you know, how important that is to that school district, and not just the high school where it was located. excuse me. This district is pretty special, but not unlike a lot of other districts across the state. David Douglas has about 80% of the kids on free and reduced lunch. High percentage. I think it's about 25 or more that are English language learners. So a lot of poverty issues. And that healthcare center is the best opportunity for care that most of these kids have. And their families in many cases. So... I'm a former teacher. I don't like to belabor the obvious. You know, if kids are sick, if they are too sick and can't be there, they're not going to be learning anything. So it's like very obvious that it would be helpful to have a good education for them. I wanted to talk a little bit about the center and how that's managed. I think sometimes, you know, when it came in, we had some questions about that. You know, here you have a healthcare center. The kids are going to be going over there, just hanging out all day, and not at all. It's actually treated as a very separate facility. It's right on campus. It's right outside the door of the high school building, but you still had to, as a student, if you needed care, you'd have to go check out of the office. They didn't cross-examine you, the office staff, when they did that, but you'd get a pass, you'd check out, get your services, and then go back to school. So it was very well managed as far as the kids that I talked to, a few of them I did talk to over time. They felt that it was a place where they could go, get good care. They felt safe. They felt secure. And I think it was really important for them. I think there's a great return on investment. You're going to get more information here from the experts that follow me. I think this is an example very similar to what happened at Earl Boyle's elementary school when we put in the Early Childhood Learning Center, where we have a small contribution from the state. And then the district voters, and this is not a rich district, they passed a bond that had money for the Early Childhood Center. And then the community beyond that partnered up, and they raised money for this. And I think that same thing can happen across the state as we try to put in more school-based health centers. So, like I said, we do have some experts here that will follow me, but I wanted to just encourage you to give this your fullest consideration. And it's a good bill. Please give it your support. Thank you.
And just so I understand the words of the summary, this bill would provide for grants from the Department of Education to school districts for developing or improving school-based health centers, and those grants would be financed by treasurer bonds, which is what this bill would authorize.
And when it gets into too many steps on the financial chain, that's why I'm kind of passing that part off to the experts that are following, but that's, I have a similar understanding to that as well.
Thank you. Are there any other questions to the representative? Who has ongoing business next door?
All right. Thank you very much.
Go ahead. Thank you very much, Representative Ridden. Please call the next panel.
Doug Riggs, Maureen Hinman.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Maureen Hinman, and I'm from the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance, a member organization for school-based health centers around the state of Oregon. We believe that that school-based health care keeps kids healthy, learning, and thriving, and that's why I'm testifying in support of House Bill 2626. So in 2011-2012, the federal government released capital construction grants, and Oregon benefited greatly from those grants, receiving grants in 20 sites around the state that averaged around $370,000, and they were used for new construction, renovation of existing centers, and for purchasing new equipment. But the money's no longer available, and there's still a clear need in Oregon, as demonstrated by the Oregon Health Authority, who did a needs assessment in October of this year. And the needs assessment surveyed 26 counties from around the state, and 20 of those said that they were interested in developing new centers. But when they were asked about challenges, they cited capital construction costs as a barrier. And one of the representatives on the survey talked about how after a lengthy two-year community engagement process, it took another 5 years to find funding for capital construction. So it really delayed the development of the center. So if House Bill 2626 passes, it would allow for 10 to 12 communities to receive grants based on the amounts that were used in the federal grants. Okay, so why school-based health centers? School-based health centers are pediatric practices that are located in schools where the kids are, and they are a public health model. So they provide integrated care that includes primary care, behavioral health, mental health, and sometimes dental care, all in one place. They are very cost effective. So for every dollar that the state invests in school-based health centers, the centers leverage an average of $2.40 from billing, grants, and other funding sources. So SBHCs have also been actively participating in healthcare reform. They've been working to develop partnerships with coordinated care organizations and improving their systems so that they can be effective providers in their communities. So 94% of them have electronic health records, and nearly half of them are patient-centered primary care homes. They provide the kinds of services that will help CCOs meet their state metrics, such as adolescent well visits and depression screenings. They are effective access points, and sometimes they are the only access points for students who have many challenges for receiving quality care in their communities. They've demonstrated that they can reduce emergency room visits and improve health outcomes. So likewise, school-based health centers have demonstrated that they can improve educational attainment, which is a social determinant of health and can impact healthcare costs in the long run. So research has shown that students in states with SBHCs as Medicaid providers have greater academic achievement than states without them. And an OHA report stated that for every avoided high school dropout, the state of Oregon would save around $14,000 in Medicaid costs over the lifetime of a student in Medicaid and uninsured costs. So that's on the health side. School-based health centers also provide a benefit to schools, and that's usually at no expense to the school other than the cost of the in-kind space. So Jackson County did an estimate based on their school-based health centers a few years ago. They now have more centers, so this would be higher.
How long is your presentation?
About one more minute.
Go for it.
Thanks.
I'm going to ask everybody, we have a ton of people who want to testify on the four bills, so I'm going to ask everybody to try and be pretty brief today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So Jackson County estimated that for each day a student visited the center rather than missing a day of school, they would receive over $220,000 based on the $37 a day of seat time that they receive for a student. So I provided you with more statistics in the written testimony, but I will move to the story in the interest of time. There was a medical assistant in the Rainier Health Center that was talking to us about how last year they had a number of students that were contemplating suicide. And so she made a special effort to ensure that when she saw a struggling student, she told them that she cared about them. So SBHCs every year do a patient satisfaction survey, and they're anonymous. But when they received them back, one of the students had written that on that day they were planning to end their life at the end of the day, but that Monica telling them that she cared about them actually changed that. So I think this is a powerful example of the difference that school-based health centers can make, not only to one student, but to an entire community. So thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions, Representative Bueller?
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Can you explain the staffing model of these clinics?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Bueller, thank you. School-based health centers are typically staffed by a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, and then they have, most of them have mental health staff. Like 57 of the 68 centers last year had a mental health specialist on staff as well.
One quick follow-up. An employed independent practitioner is employed by whom?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Bueller, they are employed by a medical sponsor, which I think 72% of the centers right now are sponsored by federally qualified health centers.
Okay.
And then the others are hospital systems or private providers mostly.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Greenlee, thank you for your presentation. I had two questions and then I'll let you answer them. Hopefully I'll be brief here. I'm aware in my profession that dental health care is kind of at a crisis level, particularly on adolescents, school age. So I noticed in the slides that it included screenings for depression. Is there opportunity to add dental into that is the first part of the question. And second, I also noticed that the CCOs are going to be benefiting in this process, helping them meet their matrix, which they get a financial incentive to receive to meet that. Will they be sharing the cost?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Hayden. So we're working to increase the amount of dental care that's taking place in the centers. Some of them actually have dental chairs, but that's fewer than those than the majority. And others are starting to do dental screenings. That's something we're actively working to improve. And with CCOs, right now we're actually working on a project in the Tri-County, the Portland metro area with all of those centers and the CCOs in that area to try to identify an alternative payment methodology that might work for school-based health centers. So we're working with CCOs right now to try to determine the best way that they can make an investment in school-based health centers.
Thank you.
We've been working hard to make sure under the right circumstances that responsible parties are billed for some of the services, but it's a complicated issue because in some cases the services are not necessarily things you want to share with the parents, and you get explanation of benefits going home and a variety of things. So it's, we're trying to find alternative ways to do it. And I think we're moving forward.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Riggs?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I will be brief. I just want to echo the point that was just raised by Representative Hayden as being a key area of focus. Both mental health and oral health have been something that we've worked very closely with the Oregon Health Authority on, and are key indicators of physical health problems and other health problems down the road. So it's certainly something we are focused on. So let me make three brief points that I think are important. This is an economical model for the state. Construction dollars, as Maureen mentioned, have typically been provided partially by federal grants. Those federal grants are now gone. But those federal grants do not cover the entire cost of retrofitting or building a new facility. I was on the Washington County Commission on Children and Families for 13 years, and I was on the School-Based Health Center Subcommittee, and our goal was to double the number of school-based health centers in Washington County. We started in 2005 with two. We now have seven. Mm-hmm. So in that period of time, we've doubled the number. And in each case, we had construction costs. The state didn't pick up any of the construction costs. School districts don't have the funding for that. But the federal grant allowed us to go out and pitch businesses, construction companies, or other grantees who would be willing to step up to the plate. And in all six cases, because we have another one coming on next year, we were able to use that small amount of leveraging to pay for the construction or retrofitting of a site. So this is a leveraging bill. Integration I've already touched on, but I really do want to focus on, just briefly, this is an integrated health model. It is meant to reach out to all the problems that a student may or may not have in their district. Each school-based health center is probably a little bit different. It's a community flavor. It's driven from the bottom up, but they all are providing effective care in their communities. And then the last thing is operational costs. This bill does not provide operational costs, but I've been asked that question. The state provides either $60,000 a year per center if there's one in a county. If there are two in a county, then they only provide $53,000. Obviously, that state support is not sufficient to cover the entire cost of a school-based health center. But as Representative Greenlick alluded to, part of the model is being able to bill and to be able to leverage private investment. And so we're taking a small state investment, putting it together with support from CCOs, health insurance companies, the community, federal funding, and putting together a package which is cost-effective, efficient, and provides better health care for kids.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank
Kenny
you both.
Kenny
Geyer. Down here. You as well?
I was just pointing Kenny Geyer.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Very quick comment because I know you have a
when
full
you
agenda.
You said this to me, I could hear you.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to say how important I think this is. There is a study done recently that shows the ratio of school nurses or school health personnel to students, and I forget if it was 1 in 750 or something, but it was very, very low. And to the extent that we can expand school-based health clinics and school nurse behavioral health in whatever format is critically important. And I think the two things here are the recent report from Chalkboard that showed the rate of absenteeism and, the assumption that there's a lot of kids that are missing school because they're unhealthy. And if we want to reach 40-40-20, we need to do this. The other thing is that because more kids are now covered in healthcare, your operational costs should be helped by the fact that you get reimbursement. So whether it's private insurance or OHP, that hopefully will stretch farther than it has. So to the extent that we can now cover more operations, the capital is what's really holding us back in addition. So it's a great, great bill.
Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm very supportive of the concept. Do you know if school-based health clinics are tracking immunizations of the students in the school that they're associated?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Buehler, yes, they are. They also participate in the Vaccine for Children's program, so they work closely with the state, and it's part of their certification standards to do that.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, I just want to echo Representative Kenny Geyer's comments about school nursing. We've been involved in the creation of the nursing ratio way back when. We've been working with the Oregon Nurses Association on the bill that they have in the Senate, which would set up a task force. And we agree school health is more than just an SBHC. It's a combination of school nursing, SBHCs, partnerships with local providers as well.
We've got some work to do to integrate those yet. There's still, even in some ways, it's two separate programs, which they can't. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could you call the next panel, please?
Roxanne Ross and Gordon Morrison.
And I'm going to ask all the witnesses from now on today to try and hold their testimony to 2 minutes. And we have it.
Hello, my name is Roxanne Ross, and I live in Gresham, Oregon. Our school board looked into this briefly also. I am really against this. You can trot out lots of outcomes that health care is good for children. There is no doubt about that. And having children get health care is a very good thing. The question is, why would the health care come from the school instead of the county health department that's already tasked with this? And why is it important that it be at the school instead of at the health clinic? Why do we need to build new health clinics? And the answer seems to be to undermine the parent. The answer seems to be that the school knows better than the parents do about the health care of their children. And I think this is a terrible message to parents, and I think it's a terrible road for the state to go on, that you would take the money out of the parents' pocketbooks and then set up health care clinics at school so you can sneak the kids in and do health care without the parents' knowledge. And Representative Green just referred to, there are times where we don't want the EOB to go to the parents. We don't want it built because we don't want the parents to know it happened. This is a terrible road to go down, and it's unfortunate that the federal government stepped in and made that money available, and that was taken away from the parents, and it's going to be doubly disappointing if you do this now.
Thank you. Sir?
My name is Gordon Morrison, and I'm here to oppose HB 2626 for the following reasons. The idea of funding any critical public function, in this case public education, on the premise of gambling proceeds strikes me as inherently a gamble in and of itself and should be regarded as ill-advised based on its inherent instability. The idea of school-based clinics in any capacity is repugnant for a variety of reasons, not least of which is the fact that underage girls can obtain abortions, contraceptives, and sterilizations absent parental consent, while they can't even take an aspirin to school from their parents. Moreover, the idea of publicly funded medical services is currently a firestorm of debate and is considered by most to be socialized medicine and has engendered no small amount of public hostility. The current state debt stands at approximately over $38 billion. So the idea of attempting to implement any new programs or expanding any existing programs, particularly of a controversial nature, again should be considered ill-advised. And to finalize this, in my opinion, school-based programs of a socialized nature, i.e., in this case, medical programs, or anything beyond what should be normal parental function, is a form of enabling dysfunctional parents to essentially have the state take care of their children when they should be taking care of their own children. If a child is in an abusive household because of drug abuse or alcohol abuse or whatever kind of abuse, for the state to be continually stepping in and filling in the shoes of the parent is simply enabling the dysfunctional family to go on abusing that child. People need to be held accountable for their own progeny. And if they can't manage their own progeny, if they can't raise them in a healthy manner, if it's an abusive situation and a teacher takes note of that and it's investigated and indeed it warrants the state intervention, fine. Absent that, the state needs to back out of the family's household. And that concludes my statements.
Great, thank you. Are there any questions of the witnesses? Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2626 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2541. Madam Minister, what do we got here?
We have House Bill 2541 requires a qualified person, and that qualified person is a physician, physician assistant, or anyone licensed to practice nursing in certain numbers to be present at blood drives. It requires assessments of blood donors' suitability to be performed by such qualified person. And Mr. Chair, did you want me to call?
Yeah, would you call the first group, please?
I'm 12541.
2541.
Okay. Sarah Basler, Dr. Mary Jo Drew, Matt Clark.
Please introduce yourself and please try and keep your remarks brief.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Nose and Hayden, and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2541. This legislation would require a registered nurse or other licensed healthcare professional to be present on a blood drive, both to ensure the safety of the donor should an adverse reaction occur, and also to assist with any complications that may come up during the initial donor screening process. You have a dash one amendment, or you will soon have a dash one amendment, that requires that the licensed staff on site be present during the donor screening process, but does not require that the licensed staff be the one to conduct all of the initial screening process. ONA supports both this legislation and the dash one amendment, and we believe this legislation is necessary because of a national trend of blood banks moving away from using licensed staff on site. Luckily, this hasn't yet been the case in Oregon. In Oregon, the American Red Cross is the main blood banking entity, and the nurses at the Red Cross have a contract through the Oregon Nurses Association with the American Red Cross, and that contract requires that the Red Cross make their best effort to ensure that there is a nurse present on a blood drive. It's our understanding that in the vast majority of blood drives, that goal is met. So in many ways, this legislation is keeping in place what has been the current practice in the state of Oregon. Because of changes in the industry, because of consolidations and companies being bought by other companies, we believe it's important to get this protection in statute and ensure that all donors have the assurance that there's a nurse or other healthcare professional on site. We think the public both deserves and expects this, and we did do some public opinion research on this in 2013. The results reinforced what we would anticipate. 73% of Oregonians reported that they would feel less confident about the safety and security of Oregon's blood supply without licensed personnel on site. And an overwhelming 82% of Oregonians reported that they could be less likely to donate blood if there was not a nurse available to oversee the blood donation procedures. For those reasons, we believe that this legislation would not have a negative impact on the volume of blood available, and if anything, would help encourage people to donate. ONA certainly understands the need for donated blood and for the safety of donors and the blood supply, and for those reasons, we ask for your support of House Bill 2541 to keep donors safe, to give them the necessary safety assurances, and essentially to keep the current practice in the industry in Oregon in place. We urge your support, and with that, I will turn it over to Matt Clark and then Dr. Drew. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's hold the questions so the panel's done.
Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Matt Clark. I am a registered nurse, and I've worked at the Red Cross for 15 years. And I urge your support of 2541 with the dash one amendment. I graduated with honors from PCC, and my family's lived in Oregon for generations, and they have been blood recipients, many of them. And so I'm proud to work at the Red Cross and give back to the family and the community by protecting the blood supply. My role at the Red Cross is sometimes as a supervisor to make sure the blood drives run smoothly and efficiently as possible. I do blood draws. I also do health histories. That is to determine the suitability of the donors. As an example, I did a blood had a donor come into a health history booth, and he had already answered all the questions, and there was nothing to indicate that he had that he was shouldn't donate blood. But I had noticed that he had a sore foot, so I asked him about that, And through some questions, I determined that he had stepped on something and he actually had an infection in his foot. There was absolutely no reason for him not to donate except that I had noticed that. And he had answered all the questions in such a way that it would indicate that he could donate blood. However, there are three questions that should have caught that are intended to catch that. One is, are you healthy and well today? And his answer to that was, well, yeah, I feel fine. I feel well enough to donate blood. Why not? Two, are you on an antibiotic or any other infection, medication for any other infection? And his answers were, well, no. I don't have insurance and I can't afford it. So now he has this raging infection, and he probably would have donated blood if I hadn't asked him that question.
Please wrap up. Would you wrap up, please? I'm asking you to wrap up your testimony.
Okay. So the point is that blood could have been, that all blood is tested and could have been, that could have been caught, but also there's another layer of protection, which is all of those questions that we ask, and it takes an educational background a lot of times to catch the things that are not inside the box of the regular questions asked. And so I urge you to vote for Safe Blood and House Bill 2541-1 amendment. I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Mary Jo Drew. I thank you very much for allowing me this opportunity to submit testimony today on House Bill 2541, which would require a registered nurse or other licensed healthcare professional be present on blood drives. I will be speaking also in support of House Bill 2541 as well as the -1 amendment. I'm a clinical laboratory pathologist with 27 years' experience in transfusion medicine. Most recently, I was medical director of the Red Cross in Portland from 2007 to 13. I have also directed multiple large hospital transfusion services and regional blood collection centers. Recently, there have been some major changes in the blood collection industry, as my colleagues have alluded to, largely driven by declining hospital blood usage over the last few years. A critical mass of published data has finally confirmed what those of us in the field have known for many years, and that is less blood means better outcomes, especially elective transfusions, for many patients. Hospitals are therefore using very stringent patient blood management guidelines to try to track blood usage and minimize their usage of blood whenever that is safe for the patient. Needless to say, blood centers are thereby realizing less revenue, and one form of cost savings that has taken is staff layoffs at blood centers. My concerns with the Red Cross plan to eliminate licensed medical staff from blood drives are based on my experience there and in other blood centers, and they are twofold: the safety of the blood being collected and the safety of the donor in the event of an adverse reaction. As my colleague alluded, a prospective donor can present with a health or medication issue for which a donor eligibility requirements may be complex, may seem unclear. The donor may not understand the questions. Non-licensed staff members do very well at basic routine donor health care screenings. However, a licensed health professional has the education and knowledge base to assess whether the donation is safe for both the donor to make and the recipient to receive. So this professional on site will be able to quickly determine eligibility. As we know, the vast majority of blood donors have no ill effect from donation. Very, very few people have any kind of reaction, but for those who do, this reaction can range from simple lightheadedness to even a loss of consciousness with possible injury. Our younger donors in high school and college are particularly prone to such fainting-type reactions. Rarely, emergency transport may be required. Non-licensed staff should not, in my opinion, be in the position of making what is essentially a medical decision as to whether or not to call transport without a licensed staff readily available. Sometimes the unlicensed staff, I have found, is concerned about either overcalling the severity of a donor's issue or maybe missing something because they're aware they don't have some of this critical medical expertise. A licensed medical staff member on site can make a sound medical decision in these situations. Our nation depends on the generosity of blood donors to provide safe and sufficient blood supply. Over 25% of all of us are going to require a blood transfusion at some time in our lives. So look around you here in this room. That potential blood recipient or blood donor could be you, could be your colleague, could be your spouse or your child. Please assure that cost savings don't take priority over blood donor and patient safety, and please continue to keep Oregon a leader in this area. I urge your support of House Bill 2541 and the Dash 1 Amendment. Thanks very much.
Any questions in the panel? Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Widener also?
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on the last testimony. I'm pleased to be a co-chief sponsor with the chairman and Representative Doherty for this bill. And something that I don't think I disclosed to you is when I was a college freshman, I donated blood. And I was on the wrestling team, healthy as could be, and seemingly in good shape. No medication, no illness that I was aware of. And I started to hop off the bed. And the next thing I knew, I was being grabbed. And I spent about 2 hours under care and spent the rest of the day in bed. And it was quite a shock and quite an education about how it's important to have people who know what they're doing present when this occurs.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Kinnemer, you'll be glad to know that I have never fainted at the sight of blood.
And for the audience, he is a surgeon, so you understand the importance of that comment.
Quick question.
I'd like certification.
And I don't think it was the blood that fainted, the sight of blood that caused me to faint. But we never did determine that, by the way. Thank you. Excuse me for interrupting.
Just a quick question. Is it acceptable for nurses to actually draw the blood?
Yes, the current procedure would allow that.
Okay.
Chair Greenlink, Representative Bueller, thank you.
I'm sorry, was the question, does it require an RN to draw the blood?
No, is it acceptable in terms of scope of practice or labor agreements for them to draw blood at these?
Great.
I have a question.
Can you go?
Yeah.
How much is 50 units of blood, the point at which you would require a second person, licensed person?
Is it two more?
How many people would that be?
That's 50.
50 people? It's one unit per person. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chair? Are there other states that have passed this kind of law?
Chair Greenlink, Representative Kenny Geyer, to my knowledge, there haven't been other states that have a law exactly like what we're proposing on the books. There are some other states that have regulation around this issue, and you know, Oregon has sort of stood out in the country, and how blood drives have been staffed so far, and we'd like to keep that in place.
Okay. Can I have one follow-up, please?
Yes.
Can you mention the kinds of regulation?
Chair Greenlink, Representative Kenny Geyer, I'd be happy to follow up with you on specifics. I know New Jersey has had something in the past.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Greenlink, just a quick technical question. I noticed that under the definition of physician, podiatrist would be included as being there, and I also noticed that dentists are excluded. Is there a reason for that?
Chair Greenlink, Vice Chair Hayden, we were trying to be inclusive of provider types when we drafted this, so there's not a specific reason for that. If there were a concern, we'd be happy to address it.
Mr. Chair?
No, Weiner's got a question.
It'll be to comment for Representative Hayden. It's because nobody likes dentists. They just cause pain in your mouth.
Thank you. We'll strike that from the record. Well, it's probably true.
Oh, jeez.
Thank you very much, Dean.
I do have one real question.
Okay.
I guess my question is kind of the purpose of the bill. I mean, is this like a huge problem where we have people going out and crashing their cars and things like that after they've donated blood? Or, I mean, the reason behind this bill, there had to be something to do it. Is it for protection for nurses? Is it because we have an epidemic of people that are drawing blood wrong? What's the purpose or the reason this bill came about?
Chair Greenlink, Representative Widener, we brought this bill forward because of the changes in the industry. As I mentioned before, most of the time when there's a blood drive in Oregon, there currently is a nurse or other staff member present. We think that that's very important and that be preserved.
Okay, thank you very much, team. Can you please call the next panel?
Douglas Engel, Jeffrey Allen, Ross Herron, Please, come.
Please try and be brief, huh?
Okay. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, good afternoon. I am Jeffrey Allen, Chief Executive Officer of the American Red Cross Pacific Northwest Blood Services Region, and I'm here today on behalf of the Red Cross to oppose House Bill 2541. We oppose House Bill 2541 because it does not enhance donor or patient safety. It would put unnecessary restrictions on our ability to collect blood for the hospitals we serve, particularly in rural areas of Oregon, and it would unnecessarily increase costs, creating a competitive disadvantage for any organization that wishes to collect blood in the state of Oregon. In today's competitive healthcare environment, in which blood centers and transfusion medicine companies compete both locally and on national levels, House Bill 2541 could ultimately serve to diminish the level of operations in Oregon that we wish to protect. It would also enhance operations in adjacent states that could provide blood in a more cost-effective manner, thereby ultimately costing the state of Oregon the very jobs we wish to protect. Regardless of any state law or collective bargaining agreement, the Red Cross is committed to a qualified workforce, including the deployment of nursing staff where they can make an appropriate impact. As such, we are proud to employ nurses in providing clinical care to patients in a variety of ways, and we intend to continue our long history in investing in opportunities for our nursing and medical professionals. We simply find that we are not exercising sound stewardship of community resources when we deploy nurses in a non-nursing function where they are underutilized. By mandating nurses to be present at every blood drive, despite the fact that every operation is performed by trained staff which do not require nursing degrees, we do not enhance donor safety, and we underutilize our talented nurses for these non-nursing activities, and we ultimately incur non-value-added costs to our operations, which are then passed on to our hospitals and the patients we serve. The USFDA, AABB, and the American Red Cross have regulations and professional standards for holding blood drives, and none require a nurse to be present at every blood drive. Such a requirement has not been standard for blood collection sites across the United States, and we know of no data or research that suggests by requiring a nurse at every blood drive that donor safety will be enhanced. The Red Cross trains every member of our collection staff during an extensive program to ensure compliance with all FDA regulatory requirements, the professional standards set by AABB, and our own high standards of performance, and our safety record is exemplary. While the Red Cross does attempt to have nurses at every blood drive in Oregon in accordance with our current bargaining agreement, in 2014, we would have been forced to cancel blood drives associated with more than 12,000 blood collections due to the unavailability of existing nursing staff on certain days for certain blood drives. These absences would be due to PTO, FML, illness, etc. Had that happened, that would have equated to a 5% less blood collections than what we were able to achieve. So by requiring nurses to be present at every blood drive in Oregon, we would be imposing a cost structure not required in most states across the country. In order for us to be fully compliant with House Bill 2541, and to be able to provide cross-coverage nursing in all cases, we would have to employ a total of 46 nurses in Oregon. And when you consider the cost impact between a nurse and a non-nurse staff that is otherwise qualified to do the same job, it is approximately a $10 difference, which equates to roughly $1 million difference for the same set of blood activity. That translates to $5 per unit of blood. And in a transfusion medicine market where it's very competitive and blood centers are challenged to make a profit, this is a very competitive disadvantage for the state of Oregon for anybody that operates here. The Red Cross does have a bargaining agreement in place with Oregon Nurses Association, and we largely comply with the requirements of House Bill 2541 to deploy nurses on blood drives. If the House bill is passed, we'll lose the flexibility and agility to respond to changing daily circumstances when nurses are unavailable at a given site on a given day for any reason. Ultimately, the impact on jobs is a reality. The Red Cross employs more than 450 individuals in the state of Oregon, but that number could be jeopardized if we create an unnecessary cost burden by requiring nurses for non-nursing activities. And the competitive nature of the industry is such that much more in the way of blood collections could happen outside of the state and then distributed inside the state. In conclusion, American Red Cross respectfully opposes House Bill 2541, and we ask that you join in that opposition.
Thank you. Next.
Chair Greenlake and members of the House Health Care Committee, I'm Dr. Ross Heron, Chief Medical Officer of the West Division of American Red Cross Blood Services. I join my colleagues of the American Red Cross Pacific Northwest Region to oppose House Bill 2541. House Bill 2541 would not enhance donor safety or the safety of the blood supply, and it would place unnecessary constraints on blood collections in Oregon. The top priority of the Red Cross is the safety of blood donors and the recipients of blood and blood products. All blood collection organizations are regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. The applicable regulations for donor suitability and blood collections are contained in Title 21 of the Code of Federal Regulations. The FDA, AABB, formerly known as the American Association of Blood Banks, and the American Red Cross regulations and professional standards do not require a nurse to be present at every blood drive. Such a requirement has not been standard of practice for blood collection sites across the United States. The Red Cross extensively trains and assesses the competency of its workforce to ensure compliance with the regulatory requirements of the FDA, as well as its own high standards of performance. Using our standard operating procedures relating to donor suitability and donor complication management, collection staff undergo extensive training, including both classroom and on-the-job training, before being released to perform tasks independently. Competency assessment occurs during the initial training period, and continuing competency assessments occur at periodic intervals throughout each year of employment. Each Red Cross Blood Services region has dedicated physicians available 24 hours a day to consult on any medical concerns relating to blood drives. Additionally, our Donor and Client Support Center is staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with donor suitability specialists and donor complication specialists who are able to provide telephone consultation to collection staff regarding any matters that may arise during blood drives. DCSC staff also provide toll-free telephone consultation to donors who may have questions or concerns after leaving the blood drive collection site. Red Cross physicians are available to assist the DCSC staff 24 hours a day as needed as well. Finally, the Red Cross tracks donor complication data through the Red Cross Biomedical Headquarters Hemovigilance Program. There are some variations among Red Cross regions, with most donor complications being mild in nature and brief in duration, like lightheadedness. Total rates for donor complications range from 3 to 6 per every 100 blood collections, with minor complications accounting for the large majority of complications. Complications that are somewhat more severe, such as prolonged recovery over 30 minutes, are much less common, with regional rates ranging from 2 to 3 per every 1,000 blood collections. While the rates vary from region to region, the data from the Red Cross Hemovigilance Program show that regions with unlicensed collection staff have similar rates of donor complications or lesser rates of donor complications as those regions with a combination of unlicensed staff and licensed staff, such as registered nurses, medical technologists, licensed vocational nurses, and licensed practical nurses. Therefore, the Red Cross opposes House Bill 2541 as it would not enhance donor safety or the safety of the blood supply, and it would place unnecessary constraints on blood collections in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Doug Engel from Lane Blood Center. Lane Blood Center was founded in 1961 to provide blood products to all hospitals in Lane County, and now provides to hospitals in Lane County and Douglas counties. I'm also representing Blood Works Northwest, formerly Puget Sound Blood Center. Lane Blood Center is an operating division of Blood Works Northwest, and part of my rationale for being here is to join my colleagues from the Pacific Northwest Regional Blood Services as basically representing all of the blood collecting organizations within the state to oppose House Bill 2541. Members of the committee, I am a medical technologist, having worked consistently in blood banking since November of 1976, both within the hospital and in the blood center setting. Indeed, our both written testimony and oral arguments indicate that we do have a highly regulated industry here with an exemplary safety record. That is certainly the case in Oregon as well as other states. Certainly, this is not just about money. It is absolutely about donor safety, to which we are greatly committed. And it is absolutely important. As a matter of fact, we are not in any way opposing a constructive nursing process and nursing presence in our centers. We do believe that those credentialed professionals bring great value in bridging the application of medical knowledge and the oversight by our licensed physicians to the practical application of donor suitability and assessment, and as well the very unusual or the infrequent donor reactions, the care that is provided. And so we simply want to direct your attention to our written arguments and then simply conclude by asking if there are questions related to our opposition of House Bill 2541.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yes,
yes, sir.
Mr. Allen, I was interested in your testimony in that the bill requires that physicians, physician's assistant, or individual licensed to practice nursing be present. You only addressed nurses. I wondered why that was.
I think I would apply it more broadly, as you say.
Yes, sir.
So, my understanding, thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that the contract that you have at the Red Cross requires that a nurse be present. What do you do when a nurse is not available currently? It doesn't sound like you cancel the drive.
We do not, not today. So in particular, rural areas, as an example, it is very challenging to find a nurse. And so that we are, we comply under a best effort. And we meet that probably about 92% based on our math. And so we absolutely do not cancel the drive. If this bill were passed, we would be mandated to either cancel or hire so many more nurses to provide cross coverage.
But you're not currently mandated to cancel it under the contract?
We are not. And I might add that in virtually every other state, it is not required, nor is it national standard practice to require nurses to be present.
One other question. So you talked about how this would put you at a competitive disadvantage, but if everybody in the state is required to have a licensed professional of some kind, I don't understand how that puts you at a competitive disadvantage when everybody that's doing blood work is supposed to have a licensed professional available.
Right. Chair Greenlick and Representative Nuss, we truly operate in a national marketplace, much more so than a local marketplace now. Just 10 years ago, nationally, 15 million units of blood were transfused annually. Today, most people estimate that to be closer to 11 to 12 million. Those that spoke before us would agree to that fact. As blood centers have consolidated to meet the consolidation with hospital systems and be able to serve both at a local level as well as across systems that cross state lines, the entities that are going to survive are those that can maintain the highest standards of quality while being the most cost effective. And it is true that any excessive cost, non-value-added costs, are being taken out of the system in terms of operations to continue to meet the hospital needs. And today, in the state of Oregon, we collect far more blood that is used in the state of Oregon than what goes to serve populations outside the state of Oregon. California does have some legislation that requires nurses present and other similar staff. And I can tell you that the cost of doing business in California is such that they depend
on states outside of California far more to produce blood and be able to effectively import it into the state to meet the hospital needs. Our worry is that if we put too much imposition in Oregon, we will cause a similar situation where organizations will be compelled to do their business outside of the state of Oregon rather than in the state.
Representative Mueller?
Representative Nose asked my question, so I'm good.
Kenny Geyer?
I'm trying really hard to get at the quality issue. You had mentioned that 2 to 3 complications per 1,000 seem roughly the same in areas that haven't used licensed nursing or above. Can you say anything about the outcomes? So 2 or 3 complications occur. Is there any difference in outcomes that are when licensed nursing or above are present versus not?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer, the outcomes are essentially similar with unlicensed staff and licensed staff. Even for severe reactions, they're categorized as severe. So, for instance, for somebody with prolonged recovery, they're treated at the site according to our standard operating procedure on how to do that treatment. And if necessary, then they're referred by EMS to emergency room care through physicians and nurses in the emergency room. So the outcomes are essentially similar.
Could I follow up? Has there been any study on cost of being able to take care of it there versus having to call EMS? Any difference at all?
Not really. The way the system is set up is that at a local blood drive, you don't have, say, crash carts, medications, things like that. So the system is set up for EMS to transport.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Next panelists, 3 more folks from Red Cross. I'll ask you to please limit your remarks to something new and also be very brief. I'll hold you to the 2-minute. Would you please call the next panel?
Michael Maudsley, Laura Marines, Corinne Roberts.
And after this, there'll be 1 more witness on support of the bill, and then we'll close the hearing. 3rd person coming?
Good. Yep. Currently.
Go ahead. Any order.
All right. Chair Greenlick and members of the House Healthcare Committee, my name is Laura Marinas. I am the collections director for the American Red Cross Pacific Northwest region and Northern California Blood Services regions. I have worked in the blood services industries for the past 22 years, and I'm also a registered nurse. I am here today on behalf of the Red Cross Pacific Northwest region to oppose House Bill 2541. As a blood donor myself, I feel 100% confident that our staff at blood drives are safe and our staff has adequate training to care for me if a complication should occur. When my own father received blood following a complicated orthopedic surgery, I can't tell you how grateful I was that the label said that it was collected by the American Red Cross. Many of the points in my testimony have been covered by our previous panelists. I want to support the message that our training systems are extensive. All staff, whether they're licensed staff or unlicensed staff, go through the exact same training. It's 11 weeks before a staff member is released to perform tasks independently. We do provide a combination of classroom and on-the-job training to ensure we have that same level of competency and proficiency. We have quality assurance departments within Red Cross locally as well as nationally who do audits. We are audited by the FDA annually. We have a high level of regulation, as has been indicated before. We also have processes in place for documenting, tracking, and trending deviations from standard operating procedures, and we ensure appropriate corrective actions are taken regarding staff competency and blood product safety.
Please wrap up.
In conclusion, the Red Cross respectfully opposes House Bill 2541. The Red Cross if the Red Cross cancels critical blood drives, those who ultimately suffer are our donors, blood drive sponsors, the hospitals we serve, and their patients. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, please.
Chair Greenlick and members of the House Health Committee, for the record, I'm Michael Maudsley. I'm the former Director of Collections for the Pacific Northwest region of the Red Cross. I'm currently the Director of Customer Experience and Loyalty for the national organization. I'm here today from Bend on behalf of the Red Cross to oppose House Bill 2541. You have my written testimony, which has more points than I'll cover here in the interest of time, but I want to touch on nurse staffing challenges in Oregon, particularly in rural Oregon where I live. Donor feedback and what our donors tell us that I think contradicts some of what ONA's testimony provided, blood collections and availability issues, and then some potential impacts on jobs here in our state. The Red Cross hires nurses.
A minute and a half to do.
I know it. The Red Cross hires continually nurses throughout the year. Recently, it took us a year to fill a nurse position in Klamath Falls, Oregon. A year. It took 135 days in Roseburg. It took 125 days in Bend. Each of those statistics should be alarming because they will result in cancellations of blood drives. When a nurse calls in sick the morning of a blood drive, we would have to walk away, even though we know we have trained staff who can go execute that blood drive safely and collect those units and turn around and get them to patients in need. So the expansive geography that the Red Cross covers and others in Oregon should be of concern because we can't rush somebody out to John Day at the last minute to keep a blood drive on. In my job in customer service for the Red Cross, I run a donor survey, and 100,000 responses to that donor survey recently, and following up with every dissatisfied donor, not one donor has asked for licensed staff to be at that drive. In fact, the biggest complaint that I do get from donors nationally is when we cancel their appointments because we had a staffing mix-up and we couldn't be there, and they're upset because they intended to donate and they planned on doing that day. Regarding blood collections and availability, as you know, blood is a perishable product. We have to have a continuous supply, and interrupting it here and there because of staffing issues that go beyond the scope of what's needed will force the cancellation and will reduce the blood supply and will not ensure that our hospitals have what they need. Canceling these drives will result in less work for people who are already employed with the Red Cross. The last thing I would say just on the impact on jobs in this state, you've heard that it's a competitive industry and it's gone through a lot of market shift. The fact is that we can collect blood in a lot of states a lot cheaper than we already do it in Oregon. The Red Cross has already made strategic decisions in other states to decrease blood collections. When you have a decreasing market, you can be real choosy about where you downsize.
Please finish.
You bet. And we've done that. And I hate to see Oregon exporting jobs because we decide we can collect blood in Idaho or Utah cheaper and then ship it back here. And that would be a net result of House Bill 2541. So for this and other reasons, I join the Red Cross in my opposition to this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am not in management. I'm just here as an employee. My name is Corinne Roberts. I have worked for the American Red Cross for 17 years. Before that, I was an EMT first responder and a paramedic. I'm just here to let you know that on our day in, day out blood drives, yes, we want nurses every time we can have them, but it is not a necessity to handle a vasovagal reaction at a blood drive. And if it becomes an issue, EMS is, I'm the one that's going to show up. I'm the one that's going to be there to take care of it. As I do take a bit of offense to licensed personnel. I'm a licensed national phlebotomist as well as a first responder. We have licensed personnel. We have licensed CNAs. We have licensed phlebotomists. We have licensed medical assistants, all of which have gone through extensive training to get where they are. They just don't happen to have an RN or an LPN behind their name. But they take their jobs very seriously, and most and everybody else is also licensed in CPR and first aid. So I agree. All of my points have been made. I'm just telling you, as a normal person that works for the Red Cross, this is going to come across in a very negative way for us here in Oregon to the blood supply. That is the bottom line. We will not be able to go to Coos Bay and run a blood drive if that nurse, that one nurse that happens to work in that area, cannot be there for the day. We will shut down. And the worst side of that is, personally, I care about my donors and my sponsors. If you are sponsoring a blood drive and it is canceled because a nurse cannot come in because of daycare or whatever the issue is, that sponsor is not going to have us back. We become unreliable. And that all does the trickle down to the fact that we will not be able to supply this state with the amount of blood that is necessary. Thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Thank you. Are there any questions of this panel?
Just a comment, Chair.
Yes.
Thank you very much. For someone who generates a lot of demand for your services, I have a lot of patients that have gone to the blood drives, and their patient experience, and this is just feedback, is not great, regardless of who's drawing the blood or who's licensed there. So I encourage you to really look at that patient experience, because I hear frequent complaints.
May I just comment in response?
Briefly.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Bueller, the procedures that you, autologous and directed donations that you prescribe from your practice are all drawn by registered nurses who are members of the Oregon Nurses Association, and we're working on the customer experience to enhance that. That is currently a nurse-only function in our region.
Okay, thank you. We have one more person to testify.
Thank you.
Joe Bryan.
While Mr. O'Brien's coming up, I wonder if an amendment that would waive this requirement when a nurse that is scheduled cancels the same day would solve some of that problem.
What was it? Wellness or something like that?
Yeah. Anyway, we'll think about that.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record,
Quick.
Yes, absolutely. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the healthcare advocate with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer group. I'll be very brief. OSPIRG supports this bill. We think it's an important patient and consumer protection measure. Giving blood saves lives. It's the right thing to do, and for the vast majority of us, it's a simple, safe, quick, and nearly painless experience, but every once in a while there's a problem, it's a problem either with the safety of the donor or with the safety of the blood supply, and we think that Oregon blood donors count on there being a nurse or other qualified medical professional on site to handle those problems. It seems like there's a pretty broad consensus across the state that that's expected and among consumers, and we think it's important to maintain that expectation so that people can have confidence in the safety of the donation process and the blood supply. So we would urge your yes vote on this bill. Thank you.
Excellent. Any questions of Mr. O'Brien? That's a model for everybody else to follow. Jesse, thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2541 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2570. What have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2570 expands the current ambulatory surgical centers to include convalescent centers. It directs the Oregon Health Authority to establish and adopt licensing rules. It also establishes an $1,800 annual licensing fee. This has an emergency clause effective on passage.
Would you call the first panel, please?
We have Chris Scoggin, Marilyn Doberco, Shelley Yuba. Yes. There you go. Please come.
Are we called up?
Yes, you're being called up. Thank you.
I'll give the folks who are explaining this bill a little bit of leeway on the time, then ask everybody else to be. Can we call for?
Are you Jesse?
I'm Jesse Armbeady.
Okay, so she would be the fourth person, but okay. I did not call her.
That's fine.
But that's okay.
Please start.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Scoggin. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. We'll just go ahead and go down the line to introduce ourselves.
No, just go ahead.
Yeah. Through it. Okay. So we are here in support of House Bill 2570. This would create a new class of healthcare facilities called a convalescent care center or an extended stay recovery center. Their primary purpose here is to target patients that have prolonged pain, prolonged nausea, maybe an inability to control bodily functions. They're able to go into a comfortable environment and enhance the patient's experience overall. These centers exist in about half a dozen states throughout the country right now. This is also a growing model, including Washington, that's considering adopting this type of structure. Do you guys want to?
Marilyn?
Are you done with your testimony?
No, sorry. Hang on just a moment, sir.
Want to finish your test?
Advance the slide.
Okay. You're looking for slides.
I'm trying to go through the slides. Yeah,
I'm sorry. Okay. I got you.
So again, ambulatory surgery centers are less than 24 hours, according to the statute. The convalescent care center, we're asking for up to 72 hours. We'd be willing to do 48 hours as well. So again, this would be a controlled structure just to enhance the satisfaction. The types of procedures that you see in this environment are typically orthopedic and spine procedures. These are the same procedures that are occurring currently within ambulatory surgery centers. We are seeing certain centers doing total joints, total knees in the ambulatory surgery center environment. Again, these would be the same types of patients, but they may need a little bit of extended recovery, having monitoring with active nursing staffing present. When you look at this is a cost example from a facility in Colorado that currently has a convalescent care center in partnership with its ambulatory surgery center. As you can see, the costs are significantly lower on the average reimbursement as what you will see within the hospital charge. This will include the cost for the convalescent care model. So on average, it's about 36.9% of a payment as compared to what it would cost in the hospital setting. And again, all of these data statistics are from a single center in northern Colorado. So as they see about 4,000 patients, about 24% of those actually utilize the recovery center model. When you look at the complications rate, that is on par with what you will see from ambulatory surgery centers and the quality parameters that are there. We have the same proposition for the triple aim as far as what we do here, and that we are be transparent as far as the quality that we
see. Those complication rates are 0.57%.
That is correct.
Well, less than 1%.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
If you can go to the next slide, please. And as far as the satisfaction rates, you can see they're both in the high 90%. So these patients are very satisfied with the care that they are given in this environment. And the center that we see in northern Colorado has typically on average 3 nursing staff members per patient on site at any given time. And as far as quality measures, this is again an example from Colorado. So you'll see some crosswalk with CDPHE to the OHA that's here. But again, they will be, you know, accreditation standards, everything that you see within the clinical standards of an ambulatory surgery center and the short-term hospitals. We're comfortable, you know, walking that over into a convalescent care model to have high quality, low cost care for our patients. And that is the end of my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's wait till the end of the panel and ask some questions. Please go ahead.
My name's Jesse Arambidi. I'm the administrator at Oregon Outpatient Surgery Center in the Tigard-Tualatin area. We've been open for about 11 years. We're a joint venture, one of the first joint ventures with Providence Health and Services, and we do have a total joint program in place now, total hips and total knees. We have not ever had to utilize an overnight stay for those patients. They've done fantastic. Since Medicare has opened up 11 new spine codes for this year, allowing those patients to be coming in to surgery centers. We're seeing that CMS is widening the higher acuity cases to be allowed to be done in a surgery center. So we think that House Bill 2570 works really well for surgery centers.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Dobberko, and I'm from Willamette Surgery Center here in Salem, Oregon. And my facility as well has a total joint replacement program. We've also done the spinal surgeries that are on the approved Medicare list. Last year, we did just over 50 total joint replacements. Our patients all went home the same day. We had one patient that opted to stay overnight. It was the patient's choice, and we were able to offer that service to that patient. But the idea is that these patients do go home the same day, but it's just nice for those that either have pain control issues or nausea and vomiting or not the ideal care home situation to go home immediately to have the option to be able to stay.
Hello, Mr. Chair. I'm Shelley Yuva, and I'm from Slocum Surgery Center in Eugene, Oregon. And we are an orthopedic-only practice and privately owned surgery center. We run four ORs and complete approximately 4,200 orthopedic outpatient surgeries. We are just initiating our total joint program. We've started with the uni knee and are now moving to the anterior hip. Again, we have the provision of the 23-hour care for our patients. They're ambulatory. We have the technology and the anesthesia for pain management to be managed at home as well. But extending that ability for the few patients that may indeed need it so we don't have to transfer them at that point. We can provide them the care. It's very personalized care. It's concierge care in a private setting.
Are there any questions of the panel? Yes, sir.
So I just want to make sure what I'm understanding. So what your suggestion here is within your centers in that convalescent care, because we have convalescent care available in communities already that's separate from hospitals and that my parents have been in there several times. So I'm just trying to understand. So you feel there's a need to have, in addition to that, that's attached to your surgery centers.
Thank you, Representative. It's more, I guess the vernacular does get confusing. So there is a convalescent care for senior citizens. I think a different term you could call is an extended stay recovery center. So this will be for surgical patients that are having a little bit more of a difficult time than what they had anticipated for the surgery. Again, persistent pain, persistent nausea. This could be someone in a younger age group as well that just needs a little bit more extended monitoring and recovery time.
My only confusion, and it's not the age thing having confusion over, because I know young people that after surgery have gone to convalescent. So I'm just trying to understand, since we already have convalescent homes, the difference, the substantial difference here in this than what's already available, or I guess I'm just not understanding what's so different about this than anybody that may now have to go to a convalescent home for a day or 2 days or a week.
Can I answer that question? I think for the patient convenience, they're already at the surgery center, and if they could just continue their recovery there, it would save them the cost of medical transportation, whether that's medical transportation or ambulance, that sort of thing. They'd already be recovering where they had their surgery.
Thank you.
The basic notion is now you can keep somebody up to 24 hours, 23 59, whatever. And usually it's working, but occasionally you need to send somebody to the hospital. So you want to change the whole model for that occasional send somebody to the hospital to allow you to establish the ability to keep somebody for 3 days. Is that?
Up to 3 days, yes. And again, this is to enhance the patient experience. So if, again, in Colorado,
patient experience isn't working now? It's a failure now?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a failure. We're constantly trying to improve the healthcare spectrum, so I think this is an improvement on the process, not necessarily fixing a broken process.
How is it an improvement?
It's an improvement that, at this point, if you have someone with persistent pain, you're going to have to pay for an ambulance ride, you're going to pay for an inpatient emergency services that can cost several thousand dollars. And the alternative, if you create the model with the extended stay recovery center, you maybe spend less than $500 total. The experience for the patient is instead of going through an ambulance, you go through a firewall with double doors, and you have a comfortable environment to continue your care and have full-time nursing staff present.
And how often does that happen? How frequently do you send somebody to the hospital?
Well, those are two different questions.
No, it's one question.
Okay.
How frequently do you send somebody to the hospital?
Emergency transfers to the hospital are typically one out of 1,000, more or less.
So basically it's working. And in one case out of 1,000, you have to send somebody to the hospital. Is that the problem you're trying to solve?
I think as the surgery centers start doing higher acuity cases, and particularly the total joints and the spine cases, there may be more and more patients that do end up needing some extended care. So I think maybe that 1 in 1,000 now would be a higher rate.
So the underlying reason for this is to allow you to do higher acuity patients? Is that what this is about? To change your patient mix?
I think that the government is actually going that way, yes. I mean, we're seeing more and more of the not allowed CPT codes ending up on the ASC list of codes that we can now do. So we're seeing CMS push us that way as well. So we're just trying to accommodate.
Okay, so what we're looking at here is the basic notion that you ought to be able to do more intensive surgery than you currently do under the existing model. Although the existing model seems to be working, it's not about your 1 in 1,000 admissions to the hospital. It's to set you up to become more intensive surgical centers than you now are. Is that the? Because that's a matter of public policy. We're going to need to talk about it if that's what you're about.
I think the way technology has changed and allowing us to do some of those higher acuity cases, they're not as difficult as they used to be. Hysterectomies are a perfect example. There's hysterectomies now that can be done much more simply than they could 10 years ago, and those patients do really well in an outpatient setting. They just need to be able to have a little bit longer extended stay.
You're not saying that as a patient. Bill Walton once said that minor surgery is surgery that happens to somebody else. Representative Nose?
You know what? I'm going to hold my question.
Anybody else?
I think you covered my question.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk today.
Next panel.
Jessica Adamson, Jim Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services. In addition to operating 8 hospitals in Oregon, we also are partners in 4 multi-specialty ASCs throughout the state. We're proud of our relationship with the ASCs and believe that they serve an important niche in our state. While we have concerns with the current House Bill 2570, it's our belief that if ASCs are going to move into a model where they care for patients longer than 24 hours, that those convalescing centers or extended stay centers need to meet the same health safety staffing requirements as hospitals. They are providing round-the-clock care to those patients and need to be able to protect those patients. In conversations with the proponents out in the hall, I think we share the same goal of protecting patient and patient safety. So we look forward to the opportunity to work with them to develop amendments that would very clearly provide that if we're going to go down this road of offering convalescent centers, that there is clear protections for patients. That's our number one priority. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might
have. We have a position on the surgery centers beginning to do more extensive surgery than they currently do?
Chair Greenlech, I'm not prepared to speak to that today.
Be glad to hear your opinion on that in the future.
We'll come back to that. Thank you.
Mr. Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Carlson, president of the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent members across the state, many of whom provide post-acute care services, both licensed and Medicare-certified home health and skilled nursing. And our members work in many communities around the state right now closely with surgery centers, receive referrals from surgery centers for post-surgical rehabilitative services, and others, oftentimes very short stay, such as is being suggested here. We had some questions that we had a good productive discussion with the proponents of the bill earlier today and had a good discussion, and a lot of our questions related to how does this interface with Medicare-covered benefits for post-acute care services. Right now under the Medicare program, in order to access your skilled nursing benefit or your Medicare home health benefit, it has to be preceded by a 3-day hospital stay, and that's been a Medicare standard for many years to make sure that the level of service needed to access those post-acute care services was of such a level. And so one of the things that question that was raised for us initially when we looked at the legislation is if we were to gravitate more services out of hospital-based settings into these settings, would we have a situation where Medicare beneficiaries could not access their Medicare-covered services and benefits that they might need? In our discussions earlier today with the representatives from the surgery centers, they indicated an openness and a willingness to sit down and have some discussions about, you know, putting some sideboards and some parameters on things. I think they talked about really trying to define maybe what types of procedures are appropriate, as well as kind of patient selection things, because they really don't have an interest in getting into what I'm going to call, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 day lengths of stay. They really don't want to, I think, change their model from being an outpatient type of a model into extended inpatient types of services. So we were encouraged with those discussions. They talked about really 36 to 48 hours, as the slides were suggested, is really where I think they're focused. And so we're happy to engage in those discussions. I think, as Ms. Adamson indicated, we'd be more than willing to sit down and try to work in a spirit of cooperation, see if we can come up with some things that make sense. But our primary concerns related around those Medicare-covered benefits and beneficiaries' access.
If I understand what you're saying, and it relates to what Representative Lively was asking.
Yes.
About. Right now, a Medicare patient has a hip replacement, goes into a hospital, spends 3 days in the hospital because it's slower recovery. I think that's an unusual length of stay, but spends 3 days, then can get their home health benefits or the skilled nursing benefits because they've had the 3 day stay. If they go into an ambulatory care center, same procedure, spend 3 days in an ambulatory care center, then they're not eligible for going into an SNF or into home health. Is that?
Mr. Chair, as I understand the Medicare rules, that is correct. And so that was one of the questions we wanted to raise and really kind of dive into a little deeper. And I do agree with the comment that was made by one of the earlier witnesses for the surgery centers that I believe CMS regs will continue to change and evolve in the years to come as our healthcare system and delivery system is changing. I just think we want to make sure that rather than, you know, punting something to OHA to come up with rules on or anything else, I think we should sit down and make sure we're stepping deliberately on some of these things.
Thank you. Are there any other questions in this panel?
Just
President Buehler.
A comment. I have some familiarity with this issue, as you can imagine. I do think the trend in the industry is to do higher acuity surgery, such as spinal procedures and total joints, in an ASC setting. And there are some federal demonstration projects right now to that effect. So this is a trend clear in the industry.
Thank you both very much.
Yep. Thank you.
We close the public hearing on House Bill 2570. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2421. We are going to have some problems with time today. I'm sure we are not going to finish this bill today, but let's try and get into it. You call the first panel and make sure anybody who's come over 100 miles gets called as well.
Judy Moore Peterson wants to kick off the bill.
All right.
And then on deck will be Josh Bishop and Dr. Mark Bradshaw. House Bill 2421 makes mental health drugs subject to the practitioner-managed prescription drug plan.
Good afternoon. My name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the state's Medicaid director with the Oregon Health Authority.
Welcome back.
Thank you. And so I am here to talk to introduce what House Bill 2421 accomplishes and just outline a couple of key points about that bill. It accomplishes two main things. One, it allows us, the Oregon Health Authority, to apply a preferred drug list to mental health drugs as we do with all other drugs, the physical health care drugs. The second thing that also accomplishes is by allowing the inclusion of payment for mental health drugs to be included in the CCO global budgets. In looking at the bill, the first section, Section 1, is a section that removes the requirement that OHA reimburse mental health drugs without any restrictions and would therefore allow the application of a PDL to the mental health drugs in the same manner that we currently apply it to the physical health care drugs for OHP open card members. And just so folks have a good understanding about that, the drugs that are currently not on our preferred drug list for physical healthcare drugs, they are still accessed and still able to be to be prescribed through either a prior authorization process or also physician override. And we would apply the same processes also for a mental health preferred drug list. Currently, we have our pharmacy and therapeutics committee does produce a voluntary mental health PDL that is that people can follow. And our latest estimate of how that's being followed, we show that approximately 75% of all claims are for drugs that are on that preferred, that voluntary preferred drug list. The second section of the bill, the more substantive section, through sections 2 through 5, allow the reimbursement of mental health drugs to be included in the CCOs and the coordinated care organizations in their global budgets beginning in January 1st of 2016, at least as it's currently drafted. One of the main reasons that that we have included that is we believe that it is in alignment with what we're trying to accomplish with coordinated care organizations by integrating all their care within a single entity. So it does allow for greater coordination and greater integration within one entity. We believe that it is also valuable for patient safety, having the different systems, not having real-time access. A patient may have contraindications between drugs that will not be caught right away. For example, a mental health or behavioral health provider could prescribe a mental health drug, but because the state, the Oregon Health Authority, pays for it, they're not going to know, that behavioral health provider will not know if they're prescribing for a person who's on the coordinated care organization, they're not going to know whether that patient picked up the drug or not, because those two systems don't talk to each other. And then also on the other side, for example, if a physical health care provider prescribed a pain medication, they're not necessarily going to know whether that person was on a mental health drug or not. And so it is for us a matter also of patient safety, besides that we believe that it's a good clinical quality of care to be able to include all of those things in the same under the same entity. So I'm trying to be respectful of time. So I'm just going to wrap up my comments, and I'll just to let you know that the committee know that we are actively working with both NAMI and the CCOs on some amendments to address concerns that they may bring up.
Why are these called 7-Eleven drugs?
Pardon me?
Why are these referred to as 7-Eleven drugs?
Oh, they're from, sorry. Mental health drugs are, it's so common I forgot that I even said that. There's two classes of drugs, class 7, and I am actually not a clinician, so I apologize if I mispronounce this, atoractics and tranquilizers, and class 11, which have the psychostimulants and antidepressants. So
they're among the other classes of drugs.
That's right. There's a series of classes of different drugs, and there's class 7 and class 11 are commonly referred to as the mental health drugs.
Is there any questions?
Well, listen, I had a question. Representative Geyer had a question. Kenny Geyer had a question first. Then me.
Kenny Geyer.
Thank you.
It.
How in the physical arena, how often is there a physician override request, and how often is that granted? Is that a complicated process? And would you anticipate that being the same on the mental health side?
Chair Greenlicka and Representative Kenny Geyer, I don't have that figure with me today on how often an override is requested. If it is requested, then it is granted. But I don't have the processes or the numbers behind that. But we can get that information.
But if it's requested, it's always granted?
If it's a physician override,
right?
You know, if we're going through the prior authorization process, and in the end they say no, this is the best drug, we will allow the physician override.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Representative Nose?
I think you probably answered my question, but I was walking as you were explaining. Explain the formulary again, just for me, because I walked in and I missed it. So, because I thought it was important.
Okay, Chair Greenlicka, Representative Nose. The preferred drug list is a list of drugs that are based on safety, effectiveness, and cost effectiveness of the drugs, and we list out the pharmacy and therapy. We have pharmacy and therapeutics committee that's made up of pharmacists and clinicians, et cetera, who put together that list.
Okay.
And then we create a prioritization process around those around all the preferred drugs. If drugs are not on that list, then again, we have a process by which. If the physician says that yes, or the prescriber says that this is the drug that's needed, there is a process involved. Unfortunately, I don't have the details behind exactly what all those steps are of how a physician override takes place.
That's basically for the open card.
Open card.
And the CCOs take the preferred drug list and create their own formularies.
That is correct.
So just so I'm understanding, because I work for nurses, but I'm not one. So the formulary is not a rigid thing. It's like a guide.
It's a preferred list.
It's a preferred
drug list isn't a formulary.
Got it.
But it helps feed the formularies of the CCOs.
Thank you.
Okay.
No, you have
Mr. Chairman.
You have
yes, Representative Kennedy.
Thank you. I guess I have a couple of questions. The first one is what does the Oregon Health Authority have in the way of expertise to override prescribers' medical determination?
So, Chair Green, like Representative Kenmore, we have on we have pharmacists and clinicians on board who work for our agency that operate and the prioritization process, but in the creation of the preferred drug list, we have a pharmacy and therapeutics committee, and which I'm happy to bring the membership back. I don't have it with me today on who serves on that particular committee, but it's made up of pharmacists, clinicians, et cetera, and they are the ones who walk through each and every drug that's under consideration, as well as all the prioritization processes.
I really hate to do this, but I think we need to be out of here in 6 minutes, and I want to call two witnesses who've come from more than 100 miles to hear their testimony. When we come back to this bill, we'll open up for public hearing, for public testimony again, and we will be back to this bill. So let me call Josh Bishop and Mark Bradshaw. Is there anybody else that's come from more than 100 miles?
Yeah, Robin Henderson.
Dr. Henderson always hangs out here. Quite a character. Laura, do you want to also take a couple minutes?
We have some folks who took time off today and came down from Portland that aren't going to be able to take any more time off to come down and testify.
Okay, why don't I give you all 1 minute each?
Fair enough.
That's better than 0 minutes.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Please go for it.
Sure. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Mark Bradshaw. I'm a psychiatrist and behavioral health medical director at AllCare CCO in Southern Oregon. I know I don't have much time, so what I will say is I'm speaking from having been a psychiatrist for 10 years in a communal health center in Oregon. The problem of the current system is not new to CCO. It's old. I would say three things: inappropriate polypharmacy, benzodiazepine overuse, and inability to assure the appropriate clinical management of high-risk medications. I come from an area that is notorious already. A few years ago, you may remember in the national news, we are the highest area in the region in the country for prescribing antipsychotics to children. And recently, that apparently is still a problem. We were asked by the Community Mental Health Center in Jackson County to assist them with reviewing the psychotropic medications that children were on because their new child psychiatrist was so disturbed by the patterns that she was seeing in the community. I guess basically to sum up, well, actually, in my initial findings on that, I will say it is still high. Children under 5 are prescribed antipsychotics. Federal and association recommendations are not to do that, youngest being age 2. To me, this is a safety issue. Most of these medications are generic that I'm talking about. This is not a money issue. I'm just concerned that we're really not addressing mental health access by having a unmanaged formulary. What we're doing is not really helping the problem. I don't see that without some type of management of these medications at a local regional area, that is going to get any better.
Are you opposing the bill then?
I actually am in support of the bill, with the CCO's managing.
Okay. Sorry. Oh, thank you.
You support the dash two.
I thought I marked
yes, dash
opposition.
Two. Sorry, dash two.
Good.
Sorry
thank
about
you.
That.
All right. Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Josh Bishop. I'm a pharmacy director for Pacific Source CCO. I'm also a past member, even as recent as 2014. Of the Oregon Health Authority P&T Committee that Judy Moore Peterson referenced. I've been in my position as a director of pharmacy for 6 years, and over the last 2 years I've participated in a role in our Columbia Gorge CCO as a governance member up there. So very familiar with pharmacy operations, state pharmacy operations and policy setting, as well as the CCO. I'm testifying on behalf of Pacific Source in support of House Bill 2421. I want to briefly summarize what I was going to speak
brief.
To. Yeah, thank you. I want to educate the committee a little bit further on the points that Judy Moore Peterson made. And in parallel to the state P&T committee process, and I think one of the most important elements of this is supporting local governance, local clinical decision making, so that we have community practice standards reflected in our formularies and our clinical policies. We have a pharmacy and therapeutics committee at Pacific Source. This is a committee of 12 physicians and pharmacists who are not employed by Pacific Source. They make independent decisions. They treat CCO patients, and they evaluate the evidence every month. And I have a meeting tonight at 6 o'clock in Bend. We have these physicians, which include a psychiatrist, include pediatrics, include a neurologist, oncologist, primary care physicians. They look at the literature, they look at the evidence for the medications, and they make clinical algorithm decisions to best reflect the community practice standards. This is not a financially motivated position. This bill, in my mind, is about care coordination, improving the management of these really important medications for our CCO patients. It's about aligning data so that we can make better care coordination decisions. It's not about restricting access. It's no longer about money. Most of you are probably aware most of these medications have gone generic. There is a broad swath of generic medications in this space available today. The last point I want to make, I'm not quite done, is that I think CCOs will do this better for a few very objective reasons. One, it's been recently brought to my attention that the Oregon Health Authority is only able to contract with pharmacies who are in Oregon. All of our CCOs are specifically, and I believe the vast majority of CCOs contract with a national network of pharmacies. We have 70,000 pharmacies in our network, which means our CCO patients can travel. They can travel outside of the state. They can refill their mental health medications. That's not true if they're getting their mental health medications through the state. I think it's really important that we broaden access for these patients who are traveling. I already mentioned it, so I won't belabor it, but I think another way that we can improve care is by having local treatment patterns, local treatment algorithms, rather, that reflect community practice standards informed by our local physicians.
Please wrap up.
Thank you. The last point that I do want to make is align customer service and administration. Today, a patient, a pharmacist, a provider who's trying to get a mental health medication for their patient, they frequently call us as the CCO. We say, we want to help you. Here's the clinical advice that we can provide if that's relevant, but you have to call the Oregon Health Authority to get access to that medication to get an override put in the system. It would be a lot easier for the physicians, for the patients, for the pharmacies, if they could call one entity who could take care of all of their needs.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Can I have, let's say, four patients for whom coming back would be a hardship? Four. Witnesses, not patients.
Right.
You don't have to be a patient to be a witness.
Chair.
I really apologize to the rest of you. I know you sat through this long hearing, and I'm really sorry about it. Please
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm executive director of the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance of Mental Illness. I'll be extremely brief because we do have a couple people who made some sacrifice to be here. Two points. One is access is important to us because any barrier, however slight,
sets us, the consequences are magnified significantly. Also acts as important because our responses to medication vary greatly, even though we may have the same symptoms and the same conditions. I look forward to providing more information on this. I would also welcome more conversation on this. To date, that conversation has rather been one-sided. So the input we would have on this issue is not reflected in any of the amendments or the bill that you see before you. We would look forward to actually having some meaningful input into this process.
Thank you. We are going to have conversation on this bill. I can promise you.
Chairman Greenlich, vice chairs, and members of the committee, my name is Linda Dunn, and my daughter's name is Sheila Dunn. She suffers from bipolar disorder, and this has been a 30-year journey for us. She had 8 hospitalizations, sometimes courtesy of the police, on one occasion regarding possession of her father's guns. She is stable at this time but lives away from me, but 5 years ago something happened. Her antidepressant was taken away, a generic was substituted, and she went into 7 months of depression, which, being very high functioning and presenting well, she did not show to her doctor any of this and kept it secret and was away from me, lesser and lesser contacts. She became very seriously ill. I don't know if she was suicidal at the time. Finally, she confessed to her psychiatrist. He went and checked his records and looked at, yes, indeed, that had happened. He wanted to do a physician's override, but guess what? It took time. When you are in that amount of agony and possibly going to lose your life to suicide, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 7 days, it's way too long to wait. So this is the problem. And many people are suffering from this. I co-facilitate a support group, and I hear this story at least every other month. We only have about 10 people or 15 people come to those meetings. So I am hearing it. It is happening. We don't know if it's the capsule, the filler, the absorption rate, or just that little bit of chemical difference that causes this. But as much as I love to talk about parity, there is no parity when you come to treating mental illness with medications. It is not the same. These medications do not work the same as a painkiller for a broken leg or an antibiotic for a bacterial infection. They are not the same. So my message today is, if a person is stable on a medication and that medication works, leave them alone and save the taxpayers and the insurance companies down the road a lot of money. Save the public from harm and save my daughter from another disaster. Thank you for listening.
I must say I absolutely agree with that notion. If a patient's successfully on a medication, they ought to be able to stay on that medication. I can tell you, if we pass a bill, that will be a part of it. Yes, please.
So I am here today as a mother. My name is Laura Yanez, and in addition to being here as a mother, I actually brought one of my son's friends down, and she was going to testify, and we submitted written testimony on her, and it's actually very important, the reason that she actually had to step out of the room, because about...
Is she here?
Mm-hmm. She,
bring her up.
She is not able to, because okay. Actually she was turned away at the pharmacy because the physician override didn't work on her medication. And while trying to get it approved, the doctor actually had to prescribe a pill that was a larger dose because that was what the insurance would pay for. And she is now having extreme involuntary movement of her neck and her head. She did sit in the back for quite a while and was going to come up and testify, but she's an incredible young woman that had a 3.8 GPA in college. She's trying to go to school full time, and because the physician override didn't work, she is now having physical health consequences because of that She is still working to get the physician override, and so Carissa Gerber is her name, and I submitted her testimony that she wrote up. I'm also here as a mother because my son has had situations where, again, a physician override didn't work. And for my family, because he was 14 at the time, he suffers from depression, and it is very... The thought of going back to how he felt before medication is so scary to him that he would rather be dead. We went to the pharmacy. We were turned away at the pharmacy, and my son had to go on suicide watch until we could get his medication figured out, because all he heard the pharmacy say is, "You're not getting your meds." And to him, that triggered that fear. Before the medication, he was a D's and F student, isolated. He was constantly planning his death. After the medication, he went to an A, B student. With medication now, he actually entered college at 16 through a special program with his school. He will have his associate's degree 2 months after he was scheduled to graduate from college. But I know even now, if he goes to the pharmacy and they say your insurance isn't covering your meds, we're going to go on suicide watch again. Because if we hadn't have been able to work it out where he could get his meds and feel secure in that, I can guarantee you that he wouldn't be planning a career in engineering because he'd be dead. Like, I mean, as a parent, it's really hard to say that. As I was writing my testimony, there was a lot of tears at seeing that in black and white. But I know that that's what would happen if something happened and he was turned away at a pharmacy because a physician override didn't work.
Thank you. Any questions, this panel? Thank you. Again, I apologize to those folks of you that have come down didn't get to hear, and I can assure you we will have conversations on this bill before it passes. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2421 and adjourn.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff.